But she was in your Christmas card, I'm sure of it. She's been in the stills used to promote the show every season, even after she moved away. But her image is not to be used in the live video, Essie intones as if she is reading, out of respect for her wishes to remain off camera. That's what the PR statement says, or something like it. But she wasn't even in those photos, not originally. She was photoshopped in. Why? I ask. You don't really care about the answer to that, do you? It's too obvious. She's in the photos because if she were missing, then people would start asking the really interesting question. Which is? I say, even though I already know the answer. Why doesn't Lissa want to come home? I start writing again, and as I do, I say, and you don't have any idea why this might be? I have one idea, but I hope I'm wrong, Essie tells me. Find her. Tell her that I need to talk to her, and that I hope she'll talk to you. What if she doesn't have anything to say?
Then at least ask her if she'll come to see me. We'll figure out the where and when once we confirm the pre-wedding interview schedule.
So there's definitely going to be a wedding then? I ask.
There has to be, Essie answers. The show must go on, or so they say.
All of a sudden, I am scared for her. Essie, they can't make you get married. I hope you know that.
Oh, they're not making me do anything. Not anymore. From here on out, I'm calling the shots.
Her voice is angry.
I don't want you feeling sorry for me. Not for one second. Tell me that you understand.
I open my mouth to say one thing and reconsider, then close my lips tightly for a moment. The truth is, I know exactly how she feels. So I tell her, I understand. About that, anyway. But I don't understand what it is I'm supposed to be doing here.
You're helping me the same way that I'm helping you, she says. If you want to get the interviews, then you'll find Lissa. You get her to talk to me, if not to you. Then, if I'm right about why she went away, there will be just one more thing that I'll need you to do.
And what's that? I ask. And this time, I have no idea what it is she's thinking.
I've read your book, she tells me, as if this is an explanation. I think it may be time to write another.
I climb the stairs in a rush once the line goes dead, taking them two at a time and grossly overestimating my fitness level. My chest is burning when I burst through the door and find the apartment empty. Mike must still be out with his law school friends, celebrating or else drowning their sorrows after today's exam. Both activities look about the same. Just as well. I don't need any distractions. I put the kettle on to boil and then pull out my laptop. It's been a while since I've read anything about Lissa Hicks that was not directly circulated by the publicity team at Six for Hicks, but this had never bothered me. She was in school. She was trying to fly under the radar. It was exactly what I would have done in her position. It didn't mean there was anything amiss. Even if what Essie says about Lissa not having been home since starting college is true, that still doesn't mean there's a story there. A teenager hating her parents for putting her on television 13 episodes a year and then reaping the profits is hardly shocking in and of itself. In fact, it's barely noteworthy. All teenagers hate their parents. There's no real outrage in that. Now, if she were trying to sue them for damages, for mental anguish and suffering, like the tightrope kid from the circuses in town, then that would be a different matter. Then there would be a paper trail, legal documents to beef up the narrative, instead of just a rich and whiny teenager angry about all the ways that mom and dad have completely and totally ruined her entire life. Also, how old would Essie have been when Lissa left? 12? 13? Probably there had been some fight that she was not privy to at the time. A boyfriend of Elizabeth's that her parents didn't approve of, which would basically have been any boyfriend of any kind. Maybe she was experimenting with pot or alcohol or Molly, the usual things. Maybe even with more hardcore drugs. Even if she has track marks between her toes, I don't particularly care. That's her business. Not that it wouldn't be a hit with Sid. We all know scandal sells. But I don't want any part of it. Still, if Essie wants me to produce her sister so they can have a heart-to-heart, I'll do what I can. As far as I'm concerned, Elizabeth is probably the most normal family member that Essie has. And it sounds like that girl could use a little bit of normal in her life. I do a quick search and come up with nothing. Apart from the official promo material from the show, there are only a few pictures of Elizabeth since she left home. One shows her sitting on the grass outside the library, the wide stone building and its tall arched windows framed by the blue sky behind her. Her head is bent over a book, her brown hair falling forward and partially covering her face. I used to sit in practically the same place myself last year when I was at Medill. Most of the other journalism students steered clear of the undergraduate hangouts. But I always liked the view from that particular patch of lawn. I checked the date. Fall of her freshman year. So she was at Northwestern 3.5 years ago. Tell me something I don't already know. Aside from that picture, there are a few other close-ups that were published in the Inquirer and other papers of that kind. There is very little text accompanying them, nothing to place the shots in time or space apart from the date of publication. They are all from that same year. Then, nothing. I reread every article I can find that mentions Elizabeth and was published over the last 6 years. There's a good amount to sift through from her junior and senior years of high school. Pieces about whether or not she would be allowed to attend the junior prom. No. And then a flurry of online activity when it was announced that she would be going to her senior prom with a boy named Carter Banks. He was probably chosen by her parents to escort Elizabeth to the dance. I doubt they've kept in touch. But it's all I have to go on, so I take a chance and Google his name. Unlike Elizabeth, Carter Banks has a fairly typical online presence, which is to say that within minutes, I know far more about him than I ever knew about my best friend growing up. Most important, I know that he is enrolled at the University of Chicago, my alma mater, which gives me options. It's Friday, meaning that the registrar's office at the university will be closed through the weekend. Still, stopping by on Monday and sweet-talking my way into a copy of Carter's schedule is not entirely out of the question. It's what I did my junior year when some senior got too handsy with my roommate Samantha. She never reported it, and in her head I know she didn't even think of it as assault. Though, as the one who walked in on them, I can say with the utmost clarity that an assault was exactly what it was. Since she wouldn't let me take her to the school counselor, I figured the best I could do was help her avoid the asshole until he graduated that spring. I played the Libby Bell card with Darlene, the woman in the registrar's office, said that the senior was stalking me, but that I couldn't report it without risking it hitting the papers. Her eyes teared up a little as she took my hand. But I think that had more to do with how much I look like Justice, even now that I'm older and my sister isn't. I could tell that Darlene was the sort of woman who would have taken Justice's death particularly hard. People will do practically anything if they think it will keep me safe. They all feel guilty that when it mattered most for Justice, no one did a thing. So, the registrar is one option. Darlene still works there, and she still sends me a card on the birthday that I once shared with my sister. but she won't be in for 2 more days, and I don't want to wait that long. Then I find Carter Banks's name in an orchestra program listed under percussion, and with just a little more searching, I learn that there will be a performance of Carmina Burana next weekend that is being rather graphically advertised as Orf with their heads. I smile for the first time since I started reading, not because I find the pun I'm using, but because now I know how to find Carter Banks. It's better than nothing. Blearily, I rub my eyes and shut my computer. It is after midnight, so I leave Mike a note and riffle through a pile of clothes until I find some pajamas that smell clean enough. Then I fall into bed. Just as I'm pulling the covers up around my ears, I hear him moving around in the kitchen. But I am asleep before he comes into our room. The next morning, I get up early and head to the campus security office. The fall of my sophomore year, I interviewed a guard named Azam Ghazali for the school paper after several students' cars were broken into. It was my first real assignment as a journalist, or at least that's how it felt. I know that if I had met Azam even 6 months earlier, we would not have become friends. I was raised to believe that there are different kinds of people and that this world can best be navigated by recognizing folks for what they are and not expecting them to be what they are not. For instance, as Mama had told me more than once while I was growing up, Lee Sherman was a drunk. There was nothing that would change that. It was just how he was made. So, instead of asking the Mississippi to reverse direction and head back up north, it did infinitely more good to fill a crock pot with stew and drop it off on Lee's front stoop. Then at least he would eat that week. There was no harsh judgment in her voice when Mama talked about Lee. His actions may have sometimes attracted her derision, but the man himself was always forgiven. Nor was there any judgment when she told me that the congregation of Reverend Nance's church were not really Christian, that they were just going through the motions, but they had none of them answered God's true call. "Don't you think I know a Christian when I see one?" Mama would ask. And Justice and I would nod because Mama was famous for her looking eye, for being able to tell with just one glance the truth that was inside. She knew when a cow was ready to calf, even before Topher, the ranch hand, who told people he'd been raised by a dairy cow called Etta Place, and that the cattle were practically family as far as he was concerned. And Mama knew when Lou Ann Laramie had been beaten one too many times and was fixing to shoot her husband. That's how she got there first and took the rifle out of Lou Ann's hands. Mama told Mo Laramie that if he laid a hand on his wife again, she would come back and save Lou Ann the trouble and just shoot him herself. "People may not have the power to help what they are, but you two best be able to separate the good from the bad. If you can't, then you're liable to pack a pound cake when a shotgun is required, or the other way round." She said this to Justice and me as we brushed the horses the day after Easter, the last one we would spend together, though at the time there was no way of knowing what would happen in December of that year. This memory is rooted firmly in time, only because I wanted to skip the talking and get back to the house, where Mama had promised we could have pie for breakfast. I complained of having to go out in the cold at all while the visiting cousins slept in. Still, even with a thin crust of snow covering the ground and the wind whipping across the flat prairie as it stretched for miles in all directions, inside the barn it was warm. I leaned my cheek against Jasper's withers and his muscles twitched as if I were a fly in search of blood. Then he turned his head around with a baleful expression to urge me to start brushing him again. In the next stall, Mama ran a curry comb over Milo's back. Justice had named him when he was born, which made him, for all intents and purposes, her horse. But Mama had said that she would take care of Milo if Justice agreed to work on the knots that had gotten tangled up in one of the lead lines. Knots were one of Justice's specialties. Her fingers were small and strong, the opposite of my own clumsy ones. So Justice sat outside Milo's stall on an overturned bucket, her quick, deft touch unraveling the line. As she worked, she said to Mama,
"Pa says that Hamson Kanan was cursed because his father sinned, that the child takes on the sins of the father, and that God made all their descendants black as punishment so that his transgressions would show up clearly on their skin."
Mama did not stop working on Milo when she answered, "Don't you two go around thinking less of someone just because he was born ignorant or shiftless or colored. It is our Christian duty to protect them from themselves so that the Lord might have mercy on all our souls."
I remember thinking how good Mama must be, how righteous, to preach love even for those who were black or brown, while knowing how badly Pa would punish her if he heard her talk that way.
Even now, long after coming to realize the prejudice in such a loaded statement, I still think Mama was brave to say what she did. She was trying to teach us as much about love as she knew how. Azam has moved up through the ranks since his watching over the BMWs and Audis in the student lot. I place a coffee from his favorite diner on his desk in offering. He embraces me warmly, then motions for me to take a chair, and we both sit. There is a picture of his son dressed in a shirt and a crooked tie, smiling shyly into the lens, placed prominently on a bookshelf next to the water cooler.
"My friend," Azam says, "you cannot be here just to visit an old man. I can tell. It is not possible that a television star such as yourself has time for the likes of me."
I wrinkle my nose and say, "You saw it then?"
"Saw it. I DVR'd it and will watch it often."
I laugh and say, "Please don't do that. But I may have another chance to grace your television screen before too long. That is, if you're willing to help." He spreads his hands wide and his lips stretch out into a grin.
"When have I ever refused the call of liberty?"
I clap soundlessly at his pun, since it is one of his favorites. "I knew I could count on you, patriot that you are," I say. "I need to know when and where the orchestra practices next."
"As you wish," he tells me,
and turns toward his computer and pulls up the schedule for campus events and security assignments.
"Shane is unlocking Mandel Hall for them at 10. Does that help?"
I lean forward and kiss him on the cheek. "You know, I think it just might." Walking across campus, I catch sight of the tower before I can see Mandel Hall, and I remember how when I first visited, I was convinced that God must live here. The buildings were so beautiful. I think that this conviction, which I told my parents had come to me in a dream, was the only reason I was allowed to leave home for college. That, and I told them I would be studying early Christian religion, which, of course, I did, among other things. I wait by the fountain and flip through the Facebook pictures of Carter Banks that I've saved on my phone. He's wearing the same jacket he had on in his most recent selfie when I spot him crossing the courtyard. "Carter!" I yell and raise my hand in a wave. He smiles uncertainly, likely trying to work out where we've met and if we've hooked up and whether it might be better to run away. I am already jogging closer and extending my hand. "Hi, I'm Libby. We don't know each other, but I'm hoping you can help me with something." He stuffs his hands into his jacket pockets and lifts his shoulders against the wind.
"Shoot,"
Carter tells me.
I recently spoke to Esther Ann Hicks. I believe you went to prom with her sister, Elizabeth?
He says nothing and his face is a blank. No confirmation or denial.
I was wondering if you might still be in touch with Elizabeth. Essie wants to find her and she asked me to help look.
Shouldn't she just ask her parents?
Maybe she did already, or maybe she doesn't think that's an option. I don't know. I just know that she needs to find Elizabeth. Are you still in touch or not? But Carter is already backing away.
Essie didn't send you.
He snarls.
Why can't you all just leave those girls alone?
She needs to find Lissa, I call out. And he stops at my use of the nickname. Please.
Is Essie in trouble?
He asks, and he moves a step closer. I shrug. I don't know what else to say that might convince him to trust me, so I try. How could she not be?
Carter clenches and unclenches his jaw as he deliberates. Then he takes out his phone.
One call, that's all you get. I'm not going to take you to her. I'm not even saying I know where she is, do you hear me?
I nod. Thank you.
Come on,
he says, and motions me to follow him out of the courtyard and into a line of students carrying violin cases or rolling cellos. Once we're inside and out of the wind, Carter dials.
Hey, Liz,
he says.
I'm sorry to do this, but there's a woman here who wants to talk to you. No, don't hang up. She says that Essie sent her. I haven't told her anything. She doesn't have your number, but I'm going to hand the phone to her if that's all right.
He looks up and mouths the words, go ahead, and holds the phone out to me. Elizabeth? I say. Then, Lissa? Who told you you could use that name?
I'm sorry, Elizabeth then. It's just that it's what Essie called you when we last talked.
Why on earth should I believe that you've spoken with my sister?
My name is Liberty Bell. I met Essie a few days ago when we filmed an interview. Maybe you saw it?
I met with silence, so I say, maybe if I text you a link to the video and Carter takes a picture of me on his phone?
I trail off, uncertain how to finish.
That's not necessary, she tells me. I recognize your voice now. What is it that you have to say?
I step away from Carter and turn my back.
Essie wants to know why you never come home. She wants to see you.
That place stopped being my home a long time ago.
She wants to know what happened, why you left, or at least why you won't come back. She seems to think that something drove you away.
Why? What did she say?
That's it. That's all she told me. She said that I should find you and get you to talk to me or else get you to meet her at one of the pre-wedding interviews so that she can talk with you herself.
Who's getting married? Elizabeth asks.
Your sister. At least she says she is.
There is a pause. Then Lissa says, tell my sister she's crazy. Nothing happened. I'm not in any trouble. I just want to be left alone.
I take a chance since it worked on Carter and say, but what if she's the one who's in some kind of trouble?
There is another moment of hesitation as Elizabeth considers this. Then, in a cold voice, she says, I told you, I don't live there anymore.
Rourke. I ran into Essie Hicks at the baseball game yesterday, which is why I can now say with the utmost certainty that the girl is even crazier than she looks. I'm not sure who I would say this to, but that's entirely beside the point. Not Mom or Dad. They've been acting truly nuts ever since their fancy tea at the rectory a couple days ago. Also, they aren't home, so I can't say anything to them at all. I thought they might show at the game if Dad finished early at the store, but no such luck. Then this morning they were out the door while I was still trying to convince my brain that it was time to wake up and start moving. They yelled something about talking to their lawyer as they left, but didn't answer when I asked them what it was about. And they were gone. So I'm alone, and there are a few hours to kill before I have to head to baseball practice. Mom left nearly a full pot of coffee, which is good, because I was up half the night thinking about Essie Hicks. Though I can't really explain why. Something about the way she looked at me makes me feel like she thinks she knows me. That, in itself, is not a surprise. Girls are always looking at me like that. Like they feel they have me figured, and are just working out how to fix me. Their solution usually has something to do with kissing, or else giving me access to what's underneath their shirt. But yesterday, with Essie Hicks, there was a moment when I thought she might be right. Maybe she does know me. Maybe she knows me better than I want to admit. I go for a run and then hop in the shower. When I get out, I can hear Mom and Dad moving around downstairs. Their voices are loud, and so I hang out upstairs, waiting for them to finish whatever argument they're having. Eventually, though, I am out of excuses, and besides that, I'm hungry. I wait for a particularly impressive bit of shouting to die away before I trudge heavily down the stairs, making enough noise that they will hear me coming. Just as I expected, by the time I enter the kitchen, it is silent. Mom stands at the counter putting together some sandwiches. Dad's pouring the last of the morning's coffee over some ice. Son, he greets me as he nods. He takes a long gulp of his drink, and I can tell that he's stalling. Finally, he says, "We need to talk." Mom's still standing with her back to us, facing the counter. She places a piece of bread on top of the sandwich she's putting together and leaves her hand there, hovering above the crust.
Suzanne,
Dad calls over to her, and she jumps a little.
Coming,
she says after letting out a sigh. In a few swift, practiced movements, she cuts the sandwiches and places them on a plate, which she sets in the middle of the kitchen table. Dad and I sit.
Help yourselves,
she tells us unnecessarily. We've never had to be told to dig into food before. But no one moves. After a pause, Mom sits down. I look for my dad, who is dunking one of his ice cubes beneath the surface of the coffee with his index finger, to my mom, who is staring at her lap. Since I am generally of the opinion that it is best to get out ahead of things, I take the initiative and say, I didn't do it, whatever it is. Mom ventures a small smile, but I can see that the effort pains her. Dad clears his throat. I wonder how long we are going to sit here before one of them says something. I don't have to wonder for too long, though, because after a painful and heavy silence, Dad says,
Rourke, I think you know that the store has been struggling.
This isn't news. Our station wagon has four bald tires that should have been replaced a year ago. It's a miracle that the car made it through the winter without an accident. But it's not just our store. The whole country is in a recession. Though the talking heads on the news say that the numbers are improving, whatever that means. Still, I know we're not rich, which is why I'm not counting on Columbia. Even with financial aid, we don't have the money for me to get back and forth or pay for room and board. I'm fine with state. I really am. I tell myself this every day. Dad takes another sip of his iced coffee and continues.
We've been riding a thin line for a while now, waiting for things to turn around.
They still might, I say hopefully, because this is beginning to sound worse than I had thought.
That's true. They might. But not in time. We're going to lose the store. The house. We're going to lose it all. I had been working out just how to tell you, but there's no easy way to tell a boy his father is a failure. There's a silence during which I know I'm supposed to say something reassuring, but my throat has squeezed shut. I can't make any noise at all. It's the shock, I guess. The reversal. The notion that for the first time it's not me who's failing him. Instead, Mom says,
Leroy, please.
He stands and leaves the room. Mom wrings her hands in front of her on the table, and I'm struck by how raw they look, how broken. Her red skin is cracking at the knuckles. They're the hands of someone much older than my mother actually is. Is that it? I ask, expecting her to say it's okay to take my sandwich up to my room. But she shakes her head. More time passes before she speaks. Then she says,
We've been offered a way to keep the house, the store. It would mean enough money for us to stay above water, avoid bankruptcy. It would mean more money than I thought we'd ever see in this lifetime. You would get to go to Columbia.
I can tell from her tone that it's not only this, there's something more. Something I should be afraid of, but foolishly I begin to hope. What is it? I ask, when she does not offer an explanation on her own. She looks down at her hands as if aware of them for the first time, and then buries them in her lap. Her eyes, when they find my own, are pleading. It's the look that gets me, that makes it finally sink in, and suddenly I'm terrified.
You would have to marry Esther Hicks.
I know there must be more to this. Background of some sort, but I don't wait to hear it.
No,
I say.
No way. Not in a million years. I'll get a job. I won't go to college. I want nothing to do with that family.
I pass my dad on the way through the living room, but don't stop. I'm already up the stairs when I hear him say, What did you expect? We knew it was too good to be true. I leave for practice without saying goodbye. I'm angry, I think. Though really what I'm feeling is more complicated than that. It's impossible to put a name to. They were willing to trade me in exchange for money. So what I feel is shame, but I also feel powerful. I wonder if this is how all those countless girls have felt over the millennia. Loaded into trucks and sold into slavery. I saw a show about that on the History Channel the other day. There were some boys mixed in there too, though not as many. For the obvious reason that even most pedophiles prefer to think of themselves as straight, and it's generally men who are pigs when it comes to sexual arrangements. It's men who trust they will suffer no consequences for their actions, while women suffer no matter what they do. I think about where Essie and I would live. Hypothetically, of course, since I'm not really considering it. There's plenty of room for me in the rectory. That place is an actual mansion. Even if I had to sleep in the garage, it would be about a million steps above the stained concrete bunker where they locked up the girls on that TV show. Maybe I shouldn't be complaining. Compared with my family's cramped three-bedroom split level, complete with its leaky roof and cracked foundation, the Hicks' house is practically Versailles. But we wouldn't be living there, I remember now, since I'd be at Columbia. In married housing, presumably, if that even exists. It'd have to be a large apartment, huge by New York standards.
what with the space needed for the camera crew and hair and makeup and that sort of thing. I assumed that would be part of the bargain. I'd be sold not into slavery but into celebrity, which I realize on some level amounts to pretty much the same thing. I think this and then I stop myself, since the idea is no less insane than it was an hour ago, and my internal dialogue sounds too close to an actual debate. I'm glad when Blake slides up next to me and claps me on the back. I can use the distraction. But instead of taking my mind off things, Blake seems to know what I was thinking, because he says, "Dude, why on earth was Esther Hicks all up in your business yesterday? I never got a chance to ask." "No reason," I say. Because it'd be too ridiculous to say it out loud. But then, maybe just to see how it would sound, I venture, "She probably wants to marry me." I'm careful to say this in a way that makes it clear that I'm joking, the sort of joke that goes over well with Blake. It's just the right blend of vanity and assholery, totally up his alley. I'm rewarded with a laugh, and then he says, "Man, what I wouldn't give to get with her, that prissy little preacher's girl." Maybe on a temporary basis, but don't you think it would be a bit much in the long term? Blake tilts his head to the side and taps a finger against his pursed lips. "I don't know. I think I can make it work. I like my creature comforts. Hot tub, maid service, no one yelling at me to pick up my goddamn underwear because there would be someone whose actual job it was to pick up my goddamn underwear for me. But you'd have all those cameras following you around all the time, and you definitely wouldn't be allowed to say goddamned. So, I can talk pretty like the rest of them if I have to. Besides, in case you haven't noticed, I'm incredibly photogenic. I bet I'd be a huge hit with the middle-aged women in Omaha." I roll my eyes in response to his overinflated ego and then point out, "I don't think they have a hot tub." Blake looks outraged. "Well, that right there is a deal-breaker if I ever heard one. I guess I'll just have to hold out for Morgan Lilly. She was pretty hot in her last movie." "I didn't see it," I tell him, and nod to Coach Willis, who is motioning for us to join him. Practice starts, and though Blake keeps trying to make me guess Morgan Lilly's bra size, at least he doesn't mention Essie Hicks again. When she shows up about 10 minutes before practice is due to let out, I refuse to look over in her direction. I concentrate instead on the ball in my hand and on Reggie White's mitt as I throw and catch, throw and catch, repeating the motion over and over until my arm is moving independent of my brain. It's soothing. The stretch and snap of my muscles and the solid poof as the ball hits my own mitt, finding its center, returning home. It's not until we are jogging back to the dugout to pick up our bags that I answer Blake's questioning glance with a nod of acknowledgement. He sidles up to me and purposefully knocks his shoulder into mine.
"Check it out, Rourke," he whispers.
"What?" I ask, though I know he could only be talking about Essie.
"I think you're in."
I shake my head and grimace and stoop to gather my things. I want more than anything to just run home and get out of there. But I know I'll have to face Essie one way or another. And since there's no way around it, I figure it's best to wait until everyone else has left. I help Coach Willis stow the equipment in the athletic building. And when we finish cleaning up, there's a moment just before I step back outside, when I half expect the field to be empty. Instead, Blake is leaning against the chest-high fence talking to Essie. The panic that I feel is like a thick tar that nearly blacks out my vision and makes it hard to breathe. I blink a few times before I can see normally again and swallow. My legs are like waterlogged bags of cement, but I force them to run. I'm sweating by the time I reach Blake and Essie, and I untuck my shirt to fan myself. Blake smiles widely, clearly enjoying my discomfort. He and Essie both are silent, waiting for me to say something. But I just glare at Blake and wait for him to take the hint. Finally, after an uncomfortably long pause, he grins at Essie and reaches out to take her hand and lifts it gallantly to his lips.
"Esther Ann?"
he says.
"Always a pleasure."
I can hear him laughing as he walks away. I wait until he's out of earshot before I growl.
"What do you think you're doing here?"
"I just thought that we should talk."
"About whether I want 5 kids or maybe 7?
The chain link fence is still between us, and Essie turns away and leans against it, so that her back is to me but off to one side. I can still see most of her face.
"I see your parents have broached the subject."
"They have?" My answer is no. She turns back and grips the top of the fence. Her eyes are burning. But behind that look, I can tell that she is scared.
"Don't say that,"
she tells me.
"Why on earth do you think I would marry you? The first time we ever talked was yesterday."
She shrugs, and suddenly she looks smaller, completely unthreatening. I remind myself that this is how they lure you in. Then they pounce and strike to kill.
"It's not like I'm expecting you to love me,"
she tells me sadly. I'm almost sorry for her in this moment. Almost, but not quite. So I say, "I could never love you."
"I know,"
she answers. And this time, strangely, she does not sound sad at all.
"So why then? Why should I say yes?"
"I think, first of all, it's easier if you don't think of it as a marriage," she suggests.
"What should I think of it as?"
"A business arrangement,"
she says simply.
"An alliance. A pooling of resources for the greater good."
"Whose greater good?"
Essie lifts her chin, a quick bird-like gesture, as if she is working out how much to trust me, or debating whether she should fly away. After she has come to a decision, she tells me,
"Ours. Yours and mine."
"You don't think you have enough already?"
"Enough of what?"
I wave my hand in the air back and forth, taking in the entire space around us.
"Everything."
I stop then and drop my hands.
"It doesn't make you special,"
I say quietly.
"What doesn't?"
"Not being poor."
"I know it doesn't."
She's looking at me, and though I don't want to give her the satisfaction, eventually I look away. "My parents want me to, but I suppose you know that."
"I know things are difficult for you financially,"
she says slowly. I snort.
"Of course you do. You think it makes me an easy target, don't you? How could I possibly say no to everything you're offering?"
"Did they tell you what we're offering?"
"No, but I think I've got the gist. Money, fame, a chance to get out of this stupid town."
"And you don't want those things?"
I turn and lean against the fence as well. We're almost back to back. I can feel Essie's eyes moving over my face. "I want to get out of this town, yes. The other two I can do without."
"But there's no getting out of here without the money,"
she reminds me. "So I'm caught then. I'm out of options. You think I'll just willingly fall into your trap?
No,
she says. It wouldn't be like that. How would it be then?
I told you. A business arrangement.
So no sex?
I see her stiffen, and so I continue, hoping that the words alone might hurt her.
No kissing. None of that sort of stuff.
No sex,
she tells me defiantly.
But there would have to be a certain amount of kissing, just for the cameras. Lily tells me you're fairly good at that. I didn't think it would be a problem.
You didn't think it would be a problem? Do you have any idea how insane you sound? I turn back and see tears in her eyes.
This could work,
she whispers.
We could both get out.
I feel a surge of pity. Wonder if maybe Essie is the one who is trapped. But even so, why should it be my job to save her? I'm sorry, I tell her. It wouldn't work. Her breath rattles out of her narrow chest, and she sucks in another. For a moment, it is silent, and I can almost feel Essie letting go. Then she says quietly,
Is it because you're gay?
Without thinking, I spit out, What did you call me? And start to walk away. I want to run, but running would be an admission, and I can't risk that. So I walk. My hands are clenched, and my temples throb as the blood rushes, pounding in my ears. Essie runs along the fence until she comes to an opening, and her feet stomp up beside me.
Rourke, wait! I didn't call you anything. It was just an observation. You're gay. I've known that for a while now.
You don't know anything, I hiss angrily. And it's not my voice, it's my father's. And the realization is enough to make me stop. I sway slightly, feet planted on the ground. Essie doesn't hear the venom, or else she ignores it and just keeps talking.
I know you made up a girlfriend somewhere so you wouldn't have to keep dating Lily. I know you're a good kisser, but you always keep your eyes closed, probably so you don't have to think too hard about what you're doing.
You don't know anything, I say again. But this time I can hear the break in my voice, the weakness.
I know what it feels like to want to be anywhere but inside your own body.
I think of all the times Essie has smiled into the camera, batted her eyes, said exactly the right thing. I have seriously underestimated her. Reluctantly, I realize that under different circumstances, Esther Hicks is someone I might be able to like. But that still doesn't mean I want to marry her. Suddenly, she takes my hand and forces me to look at her.
I'm not like my parents. I don't think the way they do.
You sure had me fooled.
Thank you. That was always the intention. And it's why I think this actually might work.
I'm silent while she tells me.
It wouldn't just be some money. It would be a lot of money. And it would be ours. Yours and mine. Then, when we get divorced, we split it down the middle, 50-50. You can do anything with it that you want.
Slowly, I say, My parents said they would get to keep our house. The store? Essie nods, but it's clear that she's not really interested.
There's more than enough in the offer, as far as I can tell, that they won't ever have to worry. But you're 18, Rourke. You should really have your own lawyer.
I'll text you the contact information for the woman who represented Liberty Bell when she sued her parents. I'm not going to sue my parents.
Well, if you have your own lawyer, then you won't have to. You'll see to that up front.
Before your long walk down the aisle, I ask, and she nods. I suppose that will be televised as well?
That won't be part of my parents' demands, but it is part of mine. I want it broadcast live.
Why?
I have my reasons. One of which is to rake in as much cash as we can if we're going to go through with this thing.
She pauses and looks at me shyly.
Are we going to go through with this thing?
I look at Essie, and the craziest thing is that she doesn't seem so crazy anymore. How much money are we talking about?
For exclusive wedding interviews and pictures, not to mention the ceremony itself, we should be able to bring in at least 5 mil, maybe 10.
I choke, and Essie lifts a hand as if she is ready to smack me, but I recover just in time.
5 million?
I gasp. Essie is calm as she looks at me.
I told you it would be a lot of money.
I'm feeling dizzy, so I sit down on the grass and lean my head between my knees. Essie sits beside me, close, so that our legs are almost touching.
How did you know?
I ask, unable even now to say the word.
That you're gay?
I've been watching you for a long time, she says.
15 minutes ago, I would have found this statement creepy, but now it seems like the most normal thing that has come out of her mouth so far. She looks down as if she's embarrassed and tells me,
Also, I know about the summer you were sent away.
My stomach twists. Essie moves her hand so it's next to mine, the fingers just barely touching. It's weird, but also comforting. I don't move away.
So we would, what, have separate bedrooms? I ask.
Naturally, she says. And you'd be welcome to have whatever company you choose.
Completely against my will, I smile. There's still a chance that all this is a trap, but there's a part of me that feels relief.
You mean guys?
Next to me, I feel Essie smile in return.
I mean guys. I told you, I'm not like my parents.
I'm beginning to see that, I say. And I get to go to Columbia.
Essie sits up and shifts away from me so that she is looking into my eyes, her expression earnest.
You could go anywhere, do anything, be whoever you want to be.
Except when I'm on camera. This stops her, and she sits back slightly and then says,
Maybe the cameras wouldn't be with us for very long.
What would that feel like, do you think? Essie closes her eyes, and a dreamy look comes over her.
Different,
she says.
Wonderful.
Then her eyes snap open, and she fixes her gaze on me again.
But I can't get there alone.
She holds this look until I flinch and turn away, then lies back on the grass and runs her fingers over the tips of the narrow blades. She's right. Her plan might work, and what's more, it's strangely beginning to make sense.
If I say yes, then we're in this together. We're partners. We make all decisions together from this point on.
Essie sits up and nods. I can tell that she's trying hard not to smile.
What?
I ask.
I think you just defined marriage almost perfectly. As for the rest of it? And here she leans forward and kisses me gently on the lips,
then pulls away and says appraisingly,
I can work with that.
Esther. I give Margot's number to Rourke in case he needs to reach me. Tell him to text first and that I will call back as soon as I can get away. We walk together as far as Locust Street and then stop on the corner. There is a swish of curtains from behind Mary Betancourt's kitchen window. Rourke does not notice, but I am fairly certain that Mother is getting a phone call as we speak. I don't want you to be alarmed, but we have an audience, I tell him. If it doesn't make you too uncomfortable, it might help if you kiss me on the cheek before you go. Rourke looks around and sees nothing because there is nothing to see. No one out with his dog or walking to the mailbox anywhere on the street. The Betancourt's curtains hang undisturbed, but I know that Mary is still able to see us through the slit between them. There is no way that she is not watching. Lissa once said that 90% of the gossip in this town originates with her. Walking home from school, there are two ways Rourke and I could have come, two paths we could have chosen. But only one of them led us past this house. He followed me left without asking, when it would have been just as easy for us to go straight up to Elm. Already, he is proving to be an excellent partner. He clears his throat before he speaks.
I haven't said yes yet, but I'll call the lawyer. I'll go to the meeting. I want to see it all spelled out before I sign.
I understand, and I agree. There's no sense in going into this blind.
After all, he continues, you know my secret.
So you should know all of mine?
I'm an open book. You can watch my entire life on reruns if you want.
Relive the braces phase. Or the day Daddy took me bra shopping in order to make him seem more relatable. To show his congregants that he is just like them. That he gets as uncomfortable about female undergarments as the next guy.
I think I missed that episode.
You're lucky. I'm told it was painful to watch. Just imagine how painful it was for me to live through. The disgusting thing is that his likability rating did spike right after that, and it stayed high for about a year. From that point on, they decided to just work in one truly embarrassing thing for Daddy to do each season to keep him down to earth.
And he's okay with that?
He does what Mother says. She is the keeper of the house. I guess that means the show falls under her purview. He would never interfere, just as she would never dare contradict him at church or out in public.
I see.
That's not how I want things to be for us. I told you, joint decision-making in all things. If that's what you want.
If I say yes.
If you say yes, I reassure him.
So I just go ahead and kiss you now?
He asks. On the cheek. That's what Mother would say is allowed. If we announce our engagement, there will probably have to be some kissing on the lips, but it's nothing you haven't done before. I'm sure you could be very convincing, I tease. He sighs and once more looks over his shoulder, then leans down and kisses my left cheek. After a few seconds of contact, he straightens and starts to pull away, but then reaches out to run his fingers through my hair as if he wishes he could do more. Nice touch, I tell him.
Normal people don't live like this,
Rourke mutters through his teeth. If we do this, you won't be a normal person anymore. You'll be rich. The rules are different for them.
Don't you mean that the rules are different for you?
I take a step back and begin to turn away. I'm not rich. My parents are. But I think it's time that changed. I wave longingly toward him and then move in the direction of my house. Earlier today, I bought a charger for Margot's phone, and I want to plug it in. Niles Jenkins, who runs the only electronics store in town, looked at me suspiciously when I bought it. He knows Daddy is a vocal critic of Apple's CEO and boycotts any company that actively supports or is run by the gays. I told him I accidentally broke Lily's charger and was just replacing it, that I didn't think Daddy would mind because the Bible says, "Thou shalt not steal," and breaking the charger was the same as stealing it in a way. He nodded thoughtfully, and I paid cash. I expect Mother to be waiting for me when I get home, but I do not expect her to be waiting quite so close to the front door. I almost run smack into her as I walk into the house, and instinctively I back away, as you would from an unfamiliar dog. Her eyes flash, but she waits until I shut the front door before she says, What did you think you were doing? What are you talking about? I ask innocently. Mother places a manicured hand on one hip and tells me, You were seen with Rourke Richards.